Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Wednesday, May 1st. We're going to take items not in the order of the printed agenda because we have some legislators who would like to testify. I will open public hearings first. First, I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2699. Would you please give us like just a 1 minute opening?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2699 modifies the brownfield property tax incentive to specify that a brownfield property granted property tax benefits may also receive or be eligible for other property tax special assessments and property tax exemptions. It also specifies that the sum of all those property tax exemptions cannot result in a credit, or so that the property tax would be below zero.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the committee. My name is Kathy McEwen. I represent House District 9, which encompasses four counties from Coos Bay to Yahats. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment in support of House Bill 2699, which clarifies that local brownfield property tax incentive programs may work in concert with more than one tax incentive to provide multiple public benefit. I've worked with the Oregon Brownfields Coalition, a group of diverse stakeholders from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, both urban and rural, since 2015 to advance solutions to help clean up brownfield sites. Colleagues, we all have them in our district, and we all have many of them in our districts. In 2016, I was chief co-sponsor of House Bill 4084, which authorizes local governments, if they so choose, to provide property tax incentives for the cleanup and redevelopment of brownfield sites. Last year, Marion County became the first jurisdiction in the state to pass an ordinance implementing that property tax incentive, and the city of Portland is in the final stages of developing and enacting a local ordinance. House Bill 2699 will allow a property owner to simultaneously participate in a brownfield tax incentive program and other tax incentive programs when providing multiple public benefits through the cleanup and redevelopment of a brownfield property. This technical fix improves an economic development tool that's available to local jurisdictions to clean up brownfields and advance community goals. Eric Knoll from the City of Portland is here and will explain the details. He's the certified smart person that's been working on this for quite some time. I think there are others who will be commenting as well. Colleagues, I respectfully urge your support of House Bill 2699, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here to open the door to this conversation. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do we have questions, or shall we hold them for the rest of the panel?
Thank you for your work.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't see Senator Frederick with us yet. Next, I'd like to call Eric Knoll, Jen Bildersee, and Tom Armstrong.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to provide brief remarks this morning in support of House Bill 2699A. My role here today is to introduce the bill and then turn it over to my colleagues, our certified experts from the City of Portland, to present on the finer details of the legislation. I also want to extend a thank you to Representative McEwen for introducing the bill this morning, and thank members of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition who have signed on to a letter of support up in Olis. Before I turn it over to my colleagues, I want to give a brief overview of the bill. House Bill 2699A clarifies that local brownfield property tax incentive programs may work in concert with tax incentive programs that provide other public benefits. Stated differently, if a property qualifies for the brownfield incentive and meets those public benefit requirements, but that property also has the opportunity to provide other public benefits through other tax incentive programs, we want to allow that property to receive multiple incentives for offering those extra public benefits. I do want to take a moment to clarify the difference between this bill and a bill you heard in early February. House Bill 2575 proposed to create a brownfield tax credit program at the state level. I do want to offer the clear distinction that what we are proposing today is a small fix to an existing program that Representative McEwen mentioned was adopted in 2016 to allow local governments to adopt a limited term property tax abatement if they so choose. Tax exemption programs like this one are an important tool for local governments to incentivize public benefits like the cleanup and redevelopment of brownfield properties. Local jurisdictions like the City of Portland balance revenue impacts with the public benefits of the tax abatement program very carefully, recognizing that local jurisdictions also have critical public services to provide. Brownfields, as you will hear, come in all shapes and sizes and complexities. This tool created in 2016 was the result of a multi-year process and a bipartisan bicameral bill. This tool is meant to incentivize the cleanup, not necessarily of all brownfield sites, but those that, but for this exemption existing, would not have the opportunity or the incentive to be redeveloped. 2699A will allow for developers to participate in more than one tax incentive program. It will permit jurisdictions to promote other important goals through the development of brownfield sites, such as affordable housing and economic development. And it'll ensure that property owners will not receive benefits in excess of their property tax liability for the costs actually incurred in the cleanup process. And through our work and conversations with the Department of Revenue and the county assessors, it will direct implementing jurisdictions to specify how multiple tax incentives will apply to an eligible property and notify the county assessor of how that will occur to provide clarity in that process. And with that, thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions. We'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Good morning. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the committee. My name is Jen Bildersee. I manage the Brownfield Program at the City of Portland in the Bureau of Environmental Services. And I'm going to start by sharing this image with you of brownfield sites across the state of Oregon. And you will notice that there are many of them. There are over 13,500 identified brownfield sites, and they are all across the state, as you can see. Every city and county in Oregon has multiple sites. And these sites look different from each other. Some of them are really large industrial sites. They might have been factories or mills. Many of them, I'm not quite ready for that one. Thanks. Many of them are smaller sites, commercial sites, maybe places that were gas stations or dry cleaners 30, 40, 50 years ago, and are now right in our neighborhoods. They're places that we walk or drive by every day, places where we work and where we live. And in Portland, that looks like over 900 acres of brownfield sites within our city of all shapes and sizes. So each site is really a unique puzzle and has its own set of challenges. There's not one tool that can address all of the different brownfield sites, or even most of them, because each one is unique. So we really need a toolbox to address many of the sites. This is why the City of Portland is part of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition. It's a statewide coalition of many brownfield stakeholders who are working to develop new types of tools and resources to help move a variety of these sites forward across the state. And part of the coalition's work several years ago was on 4084. It was a really exciting opportunity for us to have a new type of incentive to help work on some of these properties that were really stuck. And now I'm ready for my next one. So these are just two snapshots of sites that we've worked on within the City of Portland. Both of these sites were vacant for many, many years, and there was no clear path forward for seeing a redevelopment. With some assistance from existing city programs, the site on the top was cleaned up and became a place where a local business was able to expand, and it's now a commercial bakery, and that site is clean. The site pictured on the bottom was fully cleaned up as well and is now a place where affordable housing has been redeveloped. And These are the types of sites we had in mind when we convened a working group to develop a program once we had that ability from 4084 for this new property tax incentive. We spent quite a bit of time making careful choices about what our incentive program would look like, because the authorizing legislation leaves a lot of room for local jurisdictions to make appropriate choices for their community's needs and priorities. So the program that we shaped will offer a 50% of cleanup cost tax offset from property taxes. And that's for a standard site. On certain types of priority sites, a property owner could receive up to 100% of their eligible cleanup costs off of future property taxes. Our program has a built-in per site cap for cleanup costs that can be applied to the incentive. Our incentive program also requires that any site receiving the incentive work with DEQ to make sure that the cleanup performed is appropriate. And additionally, if a site owner caused or contributed to the contamination on the site, they're not eligible to receive this incentive. Projects that are eligible for the additional level to receive up to 100% of the incentive are projects like affordable housing, industrial land use, other sites that are really priority type projects for the city of Portland. What we realized when we convened our working group and started shaping the incentive was that there were some unintended consequences of the original legislative language. We all agreed in discussion shaping 4084 that we didn't want to allow for double dipping. And what we meant by that was that if a property owner was receiving another incentive for specific cleanup cost, they shouldn't then also receive this property tax incentive for that same cleanup cost. Unfortunately, the language was written so broadly that it could be interpreted that a cleanup or redevelopment receiving any type of incentive for any aspect of the project couldn't then also receive this incentive for the brownfield portion of the project. And that really, unfortunately, undermined our original intention of kind of leveling the playing field between brownfields and other uncontaminated sites. So that's why we're seeking this clarification. We really want to encourage properties, especially brownfield properties, just to make use of all of the different types of incentives that are available so that we can see robust cleanup and redevelopment of our contaminated properties. And I'm going to pass things on to Tom, who will talk more about the details.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley, members of the committee. I'm Tom Armstrong. I'm with the city's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I've been working with Jen on putting together our local property tax exemption program at the city of Portland. I wanted to talk to you this morning about just two sort of programs, existing tax abatement programs that are complementary to this brownfield tax exemption, and how this technical fix bill would help use both of these programs in combination with a brownfield tax exemption. The first program is the Enterprise Zone program, which there are currently 73 different enterprise zones set up across Oregon. They stretch from Medford and Grants Pass to Hillsborough, out to the Dalles and LeGrand and Union County. Generally speaking, this program provides a property tax exemption on new capital investments, typically for industrial and business properties. And that is for a five-year period. And then once that five-year period has expired, those that capital investment is back on fully on the tax rolls. In the city of Portland, we have two enterprise zone programs. What you see here in the gold is sort of the Portland Harbor and the Rivergate area, our primary heavy industrial areas. And then what you see in purple is out East Portland and out by the airport. All of the black dots you see on this map are brownfield sites that fall within these enterprise zone programs. And when we did our financial analysis of our proposed local tax exemption program, one of the things that we found is, especially with industrial properties, given the low values of those investments, that it's really hard to absorb or incorporate the brownfield cleanup costs into the development costs of a property. And so you really need to sort of join these two programs to make it cost effective, or as Jen said, level the playing field to really incentivize brownfield cleanup to go along with this new investment in these for these employment uses. Since 1996, the City of Portland's Enterprise Zone program has leveraged nearly $2 billion in investment and created or preserved, retained between 5 and 10,000 jobs in the City of Portland. So it is an effective program, and one of the things that really we've been pushing is that as industrial land becomes tight in the City of Portland and in the Portland region, it's really important to reinvest and clean up these brownfields and get them back into productive use. And being able to join these two programs, an enterprise zone with a brownfield tax exemption program, will really help us achieve that going forward. The second type of exemption I wanted to talk about in terms of joining up, public benefits with a brownfield tax exemption program is around housing. And
Mr. Armstrong,
yeah.
Excuse me, how much more material do you have part of your presentation?
Just two more slides.
Okay, because and with apologies to the committee, as soon as you can be finished, I'm going to open another public hearing to allow testimony
sure.
from someone who needs to leave here by 9 o'clock.
Okay.
And then we'll call you back.
Okay.
For additional information and questions.
Just this last slide shows how, for a housing project, particularly in the City of Portland, we have an affordable housing property tax exemption program, and how it can work with a brownfield tax exemption to clean up the site, provide housing. The two programs can work together, especially with housing projects that have higher value. The brownfield costs can get covered, reimbursed rather quickly, and then the rest of the project gets back on the tax rolls, and the affordable housing tax exemption can run for another for the full 10 years of the program. And so these are just two examples of complementary programs. They're not, as Jen said, double dipping. They're serving two different public benefits, the brownfield cleanup as well as affordable housing or job creation. And they work well together, and that's what this technical fix will achieve.
Thank you. I would appreciate it if you would excuse yourselves from the table and stay available, because I'd like you to come back in a few minutes. Thank you. I'm not closing the public hearing on this bill, but I am also opening a public hearing on House Bill 2787A. And we won't take any LRO information or explanation at this time, but I would like to call up. There's at least one person signed up to testify, maybe two. I'd like to be sure that we can hear you and the information you had to provide for us before your next obligation. I'd like to hear good from Matt Markey and Rick Blackwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing Lloyds of America today, a branch of Lloyds of London. Thank you for the opportunity here testifying in support of House Bill 2787. This bill comes to you from the Business Committee and deals with what's called wet marine and transportation insurance. Wet marine and transportation insurance really deals with a lot of cargo and things like that that is shipped on container ships. It could also be from our wineries here in Oregon as they're shipping goods across the state or interstate. This is a non-authorized or unauthorized type of insurance, meaning that your typical insurance companies aren't writing this type of policy, so it's not your State Farms and your Farmers of the world. This is really a specialized insurance and deals with the way that that is taxed. And everything in the unauthorized in market, if you will, of insurance is based on a premium tax, not on a profit tax, of which we currently do for What Marine. So this bill would transform from a profit tax to a premium tax of 0.75%. The idea of the tax is to be revenue neutral, and we've been working with DCBS throughout the interim. This not only brings us in line with how other products in this category are taxed in Oregon, but also aligns us with every other state that taxes wet marine and transportation insurance. DCBS has been great to work with. We do have one small technical fix that we need to get drafted to make sure on, and that, and I'll have Rick speak to that, just to make sure that from the technical side of how to actually collect the tax. But with that, we would urge your support and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Finley and Marsh, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager at the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. We're the insurance regulator for the state of Oregon. To just build off of what Matt Marquis had said, 2787 changes the tax structure from an underwriting profits tax to a premium tax. In order for us to make sure that we have the necessary administrative machinery to collect the information, get reports and records, and if necessary, though unlikely, to file suit to collect on unpaid taxes, we need to port over some of the statutes that are already in law applicable to surplus lines and put them in place here. And so that's basically what the forthcoming amendment would do for the bill. So we'll continue to work with Lloyd's. Definitely been very helpful to have that relationship. That's all that we really need to say, if there's any questions.
And Madam Chair, I would just add that there is not a lot of this tax written in the state. Most of this is written out of state and happens, these ships are coming in or whatever, and we are not the home state. But when we are, procedurally and administratively, it's very difficult to figure out the profit tax. There's not a lot of profit on these policies here in Oregon, and so this is, makes it a much more simplified process and delivers the same amount of money.
So I'm sure that you used your words very carefully. I infer that unauthorized doesn't mean illegal. It's just some term of art about how insurers refer to themselves and how federal and state statute refer to them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is absolutely correct. You have authorized insurance, which would be more like your State Farms and things like that, where they go through a different sort of rate setting process. You then have higher risk insurance, which is more unauthorized or also in the surplus line market, which goes through a different process with DCBS and how those rates are set and calculated.
It's just a curious term to
me. Yes.
And one more question for you.
Yes.
You said this is designed to be revenue neutral?
Madam Chair, yes, that is the goal. Right now, I don't know, frankly, that, well, DCBS would have to tell you how much tax is actually collected today. It is a difficult thing to figure out how much is being collected. I think this will make it a much more simple process, but at least so far to date, this has not required a 3/5 vote.
Okay, and I'm sure we will be able to have some discussion with Legislative Revenue Office about this as well. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for being here. My ears were also piqued by the mention of taxes being revenue neutral, because indeed I would argue that on its face, the goal of a tax is never to be revenue neutral. But thank you for that further explanation. That certainly helps. I guess I would certainly want to cast a pretty thorough eye on, in the most respectful way, the idea that by doing this, it isn't just making it easier to do, but perhaps, you know, losing some revenue, because the idea that there is, I would argue as a business, insurance companies wouldn't be underwriting things if there weren't a profit in it. You said there's very little profit in this. I would argue if there was very little profit, I'm not sure you would be writing policies for it. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner, I totally understand what you're saying. I can only tell you what they have told me about. They want to offer this product in all 50 states. There's not a lot of this product in Oregon, is what they have told me. Therefore, the profit has been lower. I think there's been a lot of confusion around wet marine and transportation insurance and how it is taxed, just because Oregon has done it differently than all the other states. But truly, it is our intent that Whatever Oregon is raising today, they would raise the same amount. And if we need to make adjustments to do that, we are happy to have those conversations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Hearing on that bill, either because we'll probably have plenty of time to ask Legislative Revenue Office to come up and discuss it after we complete the other item. So the panel that was here talking about brownfields, would you please return?
Are we
going to
do this? Did she say?
We'll go back to that later.
Okay, now we're at this point of your presentation. Committee, with apologies again for the interruption to accommodate the other speakers. Do you have questions for this panel on the brownfields bill? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I am curious, I was piqued by the idea that you could combine the brownfield and the enterprise zone. Enterprise zones completely exempt an entity from property tax for 3 to 5 years. Can you just explain to me how you've seen that work, or how you foresee it working, if you haven't done it yet?
Yeah, we haven't done it yet, but the enterprise zone, it's on the new improvements, or it's on the improvement side of the tax bill.
Uh-huh.
And the brownfield could then also apply both to the land.
Okay.
And the brownfield, the way we've constructed and it's authorized in the legislation, is it can extend to 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
So you could have
out from the length of the
run the first 5 years under the Enterprise Zone program and then roll over, and for years 6 through 10 have it be on the brownfield program. And under as currently written, we don't think we could do that without this fix.
One follow-up. So in the current brownfield exemption, there's no limits on the amount of time that a locality can extend benefits?
No, I believe the authorizing legislation is a 10 or 15 year program.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, to add an additional point of clarification. The 2016 Act allows a local jurisdiction to adopt 10-year mm-hmm. property tax exemption. The local jurisdiction can choose to add additional requirements and then extend that exemption an additional 5 years based on those additional public benefit requirements.
Thank you.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the local jurisdictions, exemptions, do they have the ability to incrementally identify? First of all, I assume they have to have an ordinance that allows that to occur. And secondly, do you have the ability to make partial exemptions, such as, you know, carve out public safety and carve out other critical services, and incrementally provide that, not 100% exemption? Or would that have to be in their enabling ordinance?
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, thank you for the question. The underlying authorization does provide a broad authorization for local governments to structure their local tax exemption program, and my understanding is it would allow for that consideration. What I will also say is the nature of the brownfield redevelopment exemption specifically is, you know, the limited tax abatement of 10 to 15 years will incentivize that development, but the newly developed property from something that otherwise would have sat idle or had a lower taxable value to both state and local taxes would then, you know, increase in value over time and add to the tax rolls in the long run to fund those services.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. Next, we will hear from Wendy Johnson and Eric Kanzler. Okay.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League is a member of the Brownfield Coalition and has been for a number of years. In the 2016 session bill, I was personally involved a great deal in all the details of that complex legislation, trying to get the balance right of how do we incentivize paying for these costs but not overcompensate and such and such. It was a difficult bill. I note that the bill passed unanimously on both the House and Senate, but we were trying to not do the double dipping issue as the previous panel spoke to. But we do want to make sure this playing field works. We're excited for Portland to be the first city to get this done and set up their own criteria as well. Other cities will be looking to that model ordinance that will come out of that city because it is complex. The basic structure is in statute, but other cities will be able to put on their own additional requirements to make it work in their community and looking at their other exemptions they have. So this legislation is something that we think will strengthen the tool because we do want brownfields to be on the same playing field going forward. They have to get them cleaned up first, but then the development of additional structures, personal property, those things, they need to be eligible for the same incentives that we've got in the books. So we fully support the bill and would ask for a due pass.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Marsh and Finley. For the record, Eric Kanzler representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, here quite simply to say that we support this bill from an administrative perspective. Normally, we would take a bill like this, look at it if it was introduced as drafted and say, this looks good to us. It started in a slightly different format that raised a couple questions about how multiple tax exemptions would be administered at the local level. So we worked with Portland and the proponents to clarify, as Mr. Noel detailed in his testimony, to clarify how the exemptions would be applied. Local governments do have discretion in how to do that, and they would inform the county assessors of the intent so that we would know how to administer cleanly. And for that, we appreciate the effort and are happy to support. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Wendy. A previous speaker mentioned something like 13,500 brownfield sites around the state. Is that the number of sites remaining to clean up, or is that how many had been identified, and of that number, some of them have already been addressed?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I believe that's coming from a DEQ survey type information, and so I think it's a moving number that I think there's always more brown sites being found and some are being cleaned up. So I think that's an estimate. I wouldn't be surprised if there are more than that, frankly.
Okay, I get the message that there's lots to do. There's probably lots that have already been done and somehow those got done. Can you explain how some brownfield sites have already been cleaned up and the communities are already benefiting from a redevelopment?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I think it's really about the numbers and how unclean a site is. Some of these sites, the cost just doesn't pencil out to have an incentive to clean them up at all. It could be just a storage tank, and then it's labeled a brownfield. The definition of brownfield is it's either unclean or perceived to be, and so some of those don't require it because there aren't actually cleanup costs at all. And so this bill wouldn't help that type of brownfield because once the digging is done, it's found that it's not dirty, you wouldn't have any cleanup costs. So I think this bill does the right, the program sets it up right to deal with the actual cleanup costs. And it cuts off the incentive when it's fully clean.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Garrett Rosenthal.
I have my glasses here. There we go. Chair Nathanson, first of all, pardon my slightly froggy voice, Vice Chairs Marsh and Findlay. Pleasure to approach you today. We have testified on this. I'm testifying on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon in a sort of a neutral sense, just with some cautions, I guess you'd say. My name is Garrett Rosenthal. I live in Washington County. I've been an environmental consultant in Oregon for 40 years. I've worked on brownfield sites throughout Washington, Oregon, California, and a couple other places. Unfortunately, never Hawaii. I always tried, but never got that far. Any rate, we are completely supportive of efforts, and I'm personally very supportive of efforts to clean up brownfield sites. In a certain sense, I made my living doing that. But we have a couple concerns. One is the ability or the follow-through, and I'll just sort of summarize some of the things that we said here in our testimony, which has been submitted. Oregon is great with great intentions and sometimes not so good for oversight. I'm perfectly confident that some of the larger cities in Oregon are very good at writing the ordinances and paying attention to the process of brownfields cleanup and the fact that actually things are done correctly. This is not necessarily easy in some of the smaller cities, whether you're talking about Duffer or Rufus or LeGrand or Creswell or Oak Ridge or Powers or some of these other cities, which have very limited staff, and they may have a problem that they like to develop, and they tend to be a little bit more, shall we say, generous in terms of, because they don't have the technical ability to review some of these contracts or to review the proposals put out by various groups. At any rate, our feeling is that 2699 is a little too broad, that it allows any and all tax breaks to be combined in a vertical sense, and we're not opposed to that, for example, particularly for low-income housing and so forth, but then we think that there's a real limitation when it comes to some of the opportunity zones. As you know, some of the problems with opportunity zones have to do with a long-term remission of all tax breaks, and we think there's plenty of opportunities for these things that they shouldn't be just piled on each other without a very due diligence. I'm not prepared to go into the whole detail of that. But as we expressed in February and as we expressed in 2016, our biggest concern is the basic principles of cleanup is polluter pays and due diligence. So as we noted in February, there are a number of programs for brownfield cleanups. There's 6 or 7 or 8 programs, federal, state, various different levels. And in some cases, private insurance may still be available. I know of one case where the DEQ was ready to sign off on a complex cleanup, and the public would have paid for it. But one of the attorneys for one of the past owners, and these often end up with past owners who didn't do anything, sold it, and somebody just either skipped or a family dies, and they just don't have any interest. But by finding insurance, they found that there was the money to clean it up, and so it took it off the public's rolls. So we have two suggestions. First of all, as we suggested before, a simple statement requiring in the bill, the owner shall provide reasonable demonstration and documentation that the tax credits to be allowed against taxes otherwise due under ORS 316 and so forth are requested subsequent to unsuccessful efforts to secure funding under existing and applicable laws, including grant and loan programs administered by the Oregon and federal agencies, and that due diligence, this is an important concept, has been carried out in seeking private funding from applicable insurance or trust coverage, because we think that in many cases, a small city doesn't have the wherewithal to actually pursue due diligence. They can hire people to do it, but due diligence to finding the insurance coverage that was there under the original site and whether it's still applicable. Sometimes you can't go all the way, but sometimes you can go halfway, and this would encourage that. An alternative, and this is what Representative Finley mentioned briefly, was to add a sidebar to the effect that no local property tax breaks can have any financial impact on local school funding or special services funding. In other words, some carve-out. As they testified, that is potentially allowed, but it's not clear that that will always be something that will be considered. So we do not want to stymie. Tax Fairness Oregon has no interest in stymieing redevelopment. We think brownfields redevelopment, there's so many sites, so many places, fairly simply and fairly quickly, and we want to support that. But we do not feel that the current bill, without the sidebars, does provide due diligence as being employed by the state and allocating funds. And as we know, Oregon is good at allocating funds and not always so good in oversight. And I can give you some examples of that, but I think you know that. Anyhow, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Findlay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I do have a couple of questions. One, while I concur with your thought of the due diligence clause, the thing about what you have to be careful about is how's that measurable? I mean, what is the definition of due diligence? Is it a title search? Is it an investigative analysis of the history of forever? I mean, so that would be hard to define and hard to enforce. And I take a little exception to your comment about small cities. I'm from a small city. I've had familiar with three different brownfield cleanup projects. And it exceeded our capability, but it did not exceed the capability of DEQ and others. So that's who does that work for small cities, and very successful. So I'm not prepared to throw small cities under the bus quite as fast as you are, perhaps.
I didn't mean to impugn small cities. I've worked in regional government, and so I've worked with small cities, and I know that sometimes they have limited staff capabilities, and I believe we know that the DEQ is relatively underfunded in having adequate staff to deal with all the things that they want to do. Cities have the greatest intentions, and you're absolutely correct. Due diligence is hard to define. Insurance archaeology can be very expensive, and not everybody can do that. Rules could be written to say that at least a preliminary research and at least a certification that a preliminary search has been done. It is a bit of a gray area and a slippery slope. I agree with that entirely.
Quick follow-up. Yes. Isn't that not a component of the DEQ on their initial assessment? Is that due diligence? Is that research?
I have worked in many cases with the DEQ, and I have a great respect for them. However, I would have to say sometimes their staff limitations and the number of caseloads they have prevented them from doing full due diligence or ensuring that the due diligence has been done. Okay. So it's not through lack of interest, it's through, shall we say, overload.
Thank you.
There's no one else signed up to testify on this bill. Do you have any closing comments for us on this?
Chair Nathanson, I and members of the committee, I would say that a lot of these comments are aptly stated, that the one of the condition or one of the considerations when it comes to brownfields is the cost of the property is and the value of the property is lowered from the brownfield, the existence of the brownfield, and then that can, the uncertainty of the cost of cleanup may play into the value of the selling price of that property.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2699A. Can we hear from Legislative Revenue Office about House Bill 2787? We have already received our public testimony, and now I'd like to hear any additional information from the LRO.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this bill comes to us from the House Committee on Business and Labor. The bill seeks to distinguish between taxation schemes for admitted and not admitted or authorized and unauthorized wet marine and transportation insurers. It adjusts language to clarify that only the authorized insurers, and these were the State Farm type insurers that the testimony mentioned, that only those insurers will pay a tax on the profit earned, and these unauthorized or non-admitted insurers will instead, under the current bill, pay a tax equal to 0.75% of gross receipts from the sale of this of these premiums. Currently, there's no fiscal impact, and a revenue light statement was issued to transfer the bill between committees, but I am working on understanding how taxation currently works and also updating the revenue impact.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding, because I made myself a note, that there was an amendment coming for that, so that will clean up kind of the language on.
I would appreciate it if the amendment, instead of being sort of an ad hoc on your own amendment, was worked out with Legislative Revenue Office.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I will make sure, I made a note of that as well, and I'll make sure to get in touch with DCBS so that we're all on the same page.
Okay, good. Is that it?
Thank you.
I think that that completes our work on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2787A. And now we're ready to move to an informational meeting on the senior deferral program. Oh, welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm going to give a copy to both. I'm not quite done yet. I'm not trying to trick you.
Okay, thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Austin. I just put together this little table spreadsheet to talk about the different bills that are related to the senior deferral program under the Department of Revenue. You might remember that the senior deferral program essentially allows the property owner, the homeowner, to not pay their property taxes until sale or death, essentially, and the Department of Revenue pays their property taxes to the local jurisdictions in the meantime and accrues a deferral account. So there are several bills, we have one bill, House Bill 2587A, which essentially was from Representative Meek, and there's a group of people that have reverse mortgages, those reverse mortgages were completed between 2011 and 2017, and that bill would allow those people back in to address the equity component, which is normally 20%, requires them to have 40% equity in their property. House Bill 2151 changes the sunset, but leaves everything else relatively alone. So it pushes out the sunset for another 10 years from 2021 to 2031. 2103 is from the Department of Revenue, and it doesn't extend the sunset, but it eliminates the sunset. And then what happens now is currently there's not written in statute a process for what happens if people apply late under the program. So the Department of Revenue has worked to craft this so that there's a process, and then it also establishes a late filing fee. And then Representative Finley sponsored House Bill 2452 and essentially sets an alternative cap on the value of the house. The property is currently measured against median real market value of the housing in that area, along with the length of time that the person has lived in the home. And then this would set an alternative cap so that the property value could escalate up to at least $250,000 before it starts hitting a threshold that would restrict it from being allowed into the program. And then House Bill 2460, with some amendments, provides that descendants aren't responsible for the deferred property if the taxes if the state's underwater. And the dash two put some language about individuals that would either inherit the house or be gifted the house, and saying that if they are essentially utilizing the house, they're living in it, leasing it out, or they've received it as a gift, then in that case, they would not be relieved from the responsibility of paying those taxes. So that table was sort of to put in perspective all the different bills that are dealing with senior deferral and allow you to contemplate policy decisions.
Thank you. Committee discussion, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this, Jamie. Thank you for taking our wide and varied things and putting them in an easily understandable and manageable form, which is something you do particularly well. Thank you very much. So, at the risk of sounding like a Grinch, The 2460, the dash two. Are there other parts of an inheritance that you can just kind of wave off if it happens to be, like, are there, are if you are the inheritor of a person's estate and they have, say, credit card debt or other things like that, is the estate still, I guess I'm trying to, this seems like a handy if you, you know, if so if you inherit an estate and it's in great shape, that's great, but if, you know, you owe the state taxes, oh, well, that's fine, you shouldn't have to pay for that. So I'm trying to not in a, you know, in a, is there precedent for that in other kinds of estate law that you're not responsible for some version of your debt if you are the inheritor? And I don't know if you're an inheritance attorney, but I'm pretty sure you're not. Wouldn't surprise me, though.
We do everything at
exactly.
LRO.
Exactly.
Rep. Smith Warner, Chair Nathanson. My understanding about this particular bill is that if the estate is entirely underwater, so it's not, I think, just that you are receiving the property, but you have that the estate has a bunch of other money that would help you pay the estate. So that's not the property taxes. That's not the case. The contemplation here is that the whole property and estate is underwater. So essentially, someone is passing on a legacy of debt to you. As far as other types of treatment, Mark might be more apt to answer that given his work at the Department of Revenue, or we could look into that further. I don't know that scope of tax law and okay. forgiveness.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You would like to hear from me? Yes. Mr. Garst, could you please...
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. So just in the interest of full disclosure, this bill was brought by the state bar, and with the way that the introduced bills drafted, the department had a lot of concerns. The state bar did work with us very closely, and I just want you to know that the language that's in the that's in the amendment, it's the dash two, is actually language that's taken straight out of the Department of Revenue's administrative mm-hmm. rule. So we had initially rolled out the collection from transferees. And so if you think about it, your parent maybe has a home, maybe they owe more on the mortgage, and then you add in the senior deferral debt, and it could be that the home is actually underwater. They leave it to you, they're trying to be nice, but suddenly you have a debt, and you know, and I think that folks do have an ability to just kind of leave the keys on the table. I'm not an estate attorney, and I don't know that, but we were doing collections, and we kind of bumped into these issues where you might have one sibling who's living in the home, not paying the taxes, just waiting for the county to do a tax foreclosure. You have another sibling who maybe has a good job, but really has no interest in the home. Necessarily, the state's not resolved. We don't know who it's going to go to, and we initiate collection on both of them. We're allowed to do collection on each for the full amount, and you can imagine which one is likely to pay. And so there was a lot of frustration that was generated. We looked at the issue very closely. We felt like it was rather unfair the way that we were treating people, and so we adopted this administrative rule to clarify how we would use the authority to collect from transferees. And so that's kind of the lay of the land today. And I think that from the state bar's perspective, I won't speak for them, they're here, but I think that they would feel more comfortable if the language was in statute so that you folks would be the ones who would have the ability to change the language down the road rather than the Department of Revenue having the ability to come in and change our rule at a later date.
Can I ask a quick follow-up? Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mark. And I guess the other part that I'm trying to check on is ultimately, if there is a mortgage underwater or not, it is the bank who is responsible. That's the bank's problem, per se, right? So I guess my question is, how is that? Why is the payment? Why would the payment of the property taxes not be the mortgage holder's responsibility?
So, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, it works off of lien position. And so the mortgage is in first position, generally above the deferral program. If there's a deferral lien, before they'll issue the mortgage, they'll pay off the deferral lien, and then they'll wrap that up in the mortgage, and then the person will join the program again. So we are almost always in second position. Mm-hmm. And we do write off debt in mortgage foreclosures. with some frequency. So just from memory, I think that we're writing off roughly $500,000 a year for the last few years in those types of situations. So it's not uncommon that the deferral program does lose some money. It's part of the program. We're in a sense, we're a lender of last resort. So we don't look at, we don't get to decide based off of somebody's ability to repay whether or not they join the program. We're targeting lower income folks with not that many assets. And so it's not surprising.
Our focus is that policy goal, which is good regardless of some bad outcomes.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Nathan. General Mark, if your administrative rule that you have written there solves the most of the issue, and you guys recognized an issue, you seem to have dealt with it, why should we pass a law? Why should we make it in statute that is hard to, that would just add more stuff to the matrix that we have on all the issues affecting this?
And so, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Finley, I know that the state bar is here, but my understanding is that some members of the bar felt like they would rather that you folks have the authority to change this down the road, not that it be at the department's discretion, I think is what they were thinking.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Garst, you may have answered this already, but do you understand or have an idea of the revenue impact if 2460 went through with the -2 amendment to the department?
Well, Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, I would defer to LRO on how it is that they would do a revenue impact. But like I said, this is already the policy that we're following, and it's by administrative rule, which carries the full weight of law unless the department, you know, changes it down the road or if the legislature does something that steps on this language. So I don't see a change for us practically.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Garst? Let's return to discussion of having this array of various bills in front of us on the same topic. Any thoughts there? Otherwise, it's fine for us to just continue to mull it over for the coming days. Representative Findlay.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd be happy to give my comments. I have concerns about allowing reverse mortgages back in as we have issues. I mean, that puts people in an upside down and a precarious position, and then we have to refer down to 2460 a lot more. You know, I just have a concern with that, with 2587A, just because of that. And go down the list, 2151 has the sunset extension. The sunset extension, which I believe sunsets are a good thing because it makes you look at bills every on a periodic basis. 2103 eliminates it, which I don't like, because back to my previous statement, I really like 2452 because that was eloquently written and completely drafted in an incredible manner. So, but it also extends the sunset as a component of that. Doesn't it?
Oh, sure. I just wanted to point out something to the committee, which I think is obvious, that obviously Elsie is able to mix and match if you have a goal of extending the sunset, but you'd also like to add a path for late filing or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm good with whatever the committee comes up with.
Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I ask about that late fee? Could you remind us what that, because something that you just said made me wonder, is that like allow a late fee that right now you can't have one and you can't pay late? Or I guess, could you clarify a little bit what that means? He establishes a 10% late fee.
Representative Smith-Warner, I think right now that in statute there isn't language that describes what would happen if you don't apply within the window that's specified. So this allows a path for application to the senior deferral program. So you know that in Oregon we have property assessed on January 1st. Then the property tax year doesn't start until July, and then your bills come out in October, November. So There's a window of application, and then this establishes, I think, an April 15th deadline. And yeah, an April 15th deadline, as it just essentially establishes a date upon which after you are late, and then also establishes the 10% fee, but the 10% fee is sort of follows along with now that the fact that there is a path for late filing versus before there wasn't.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
And I just, excuse me, Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to mention also, we did do a little technical language for Representative Finley's bill 2452, that floor cap language, which seemed slightly awkward. We fixed that language to make it an alternative cap instead of a cap of floors or floor of caps.
Representative
Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I am comfortable with most of the big concepts that are listed here. There's some repetition, and we can do some combining and some streamlining. I agree with Rep. Finley that 2452 is beautifully crafted and should move forward. And I also think the late fee is a really good way to accommodate people who just didn't think ahead fast enough. But I'm also supportive of the reverse mortgages. As I understand it, these particular years fall into a gap. We don't have the problem with reverse mortgages in the future. We took care of the gap that preceded 2011. We're ensuring that the homes have adequate amount of equity, so that the downside of doing this would be, of course, if we are going upside down and adding to that $500,000 subsidy, essentially, that we are now providing to the senior deferral program. But it seems to me with, as long as we are really ensuring that the homes that go into the program should reasonably have the ability to maintain enough equity so that the property tax can be repaid, I think that's a reasonable accommodation to people who are in that gap period. So I from my point of view, I would suggest streamlining these and picking one or two bills to go forward and then just amending them sufficiently to be able to do that.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only comment that I add, and I don't disagree with you, my biggest fear with the reverse mortgage component of it is it puts the state in second position. Because if they put a reverse mortgage, that's more than likely in first, and it's ahead of us. I mean, I'm looking to Mr. Gast whether I'm speaking correctly or not. So it weakens our ability when that's the case, and that's my biggest fear about it. If the equity's still there, but it still weakens our position.
Response. Mm-hmm. But we are always in second position on these liens.
Well, the home could be paid off. I mean, that's not all, it's not all the always the case.
A mortgage of any kind, mm-hmm. It's going to have first position.
Yep.
Committee, thank you for the discussion this morning. I think we've done all we're going to for today on this topic. Stay tuned. We'll keep working at it. I'm closing the informational meeting. On senior deferral program, there is no other business before us. We are adjourned.